Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Here's the pitch, swung on. Fly ball out into left center. It's deep. It's up and gone. Left center on the catwalk. Right up above their bullpen. Doc got it up. Glanville got it up big time.
Doug Glanville, not known as a home run hitter, but he is a guy who gets the bat on the ball consistently and hits it sharply in a ballpark like this that can pay off.
Doug Glanville on the pinch hit. Runner goes. And a base hit on a hit run into left center. Conine, a diving attempt. It'll get by. Walton racing around. He will score. On his way to third, Glanville, and he's in there with a run-scoring triple.
Line drive right field, coming high. Bautista can't get it. Glanville's going to get at least three. He might circle him. He might circle him. But Boots waving him on. Boots waving him on. It's an inside the park home run. Doug Glanville.
Hit and run with Matt Spiegel. Sunday mornings on The Score.
Nice to have some highlights from an MLB career. Outstanding. Doug Glanville joining us right now on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. It's hit and run on 670 The Score. Doug, was that Harry Callis? I wasn't sure if that's who that was on the call, or do I have my eras confused?
You got it, Matt. I mean, wow. I mean, I just get chills listening to Harry Callis. I was fortunate to play for two Harrys, with Carey and Callis, legends, and just to hear the call was just as much excitement as hitting it. I'll tell you, that voice is just timeless.
Right? I mean, that is, some people just sound like baseball and always and forever will, whether it's Jack Buck or, but you had Harry and Harry calling your seasons. Not so bad. I assume that the Paul Mall was burning in the ashtray while he made that call. I think that's what he smoked.
Yeah, he had, and he come in his white suits, and he would sit in the back of the plane, which was unheard of for media, but he had been kind of grandfathered in since the 70s, 80s. So he had a lot of, passes because he was kind of one of the players, and it was a great honor to listen to him, and he would call like fantasy drafts just on his spare time. they were great. I still have a letter that Harry Carey gave me at the end of my rookie year, just to compliment me on a good first season and stuff. So they paint the pictures of the game, and it's so important.
Yeah, your reverence for the game is obvious in everything that you write and whenever you talk about it. And it's infectious, Doug. And so what a pleasure it was for you to get to play and now to get to talk about. And I heard that reverence coming through when you and Jason talked to Bob Costas the other day. It was a terrific episode of Starkville with Bob Costas on there. And talk about some people who just kind of sound like the game. Well, I guess Bob sounds like whatever sport he's doing. But what did you take away from that conversation? Because I had a couple things I wanted to run by you, but what did you take away from it?
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, Bob Costas was, the voice certainly of my childhood coming up. I mean, he worked 40 years in covering sports, and that's kind of around when my fandom, you know, really kicked into gear to present day. But I took a lot away. I know that he's always had a lot of different thoughts on the game, especially when it comes to these type of moments where not only we're dealing with unprecedented times, but we're looking at sort of the union versus, you know, players association versus the ownership, figuring out how to move forward. And so, you know, what kind of playoff systems do you have? Like, how do you handle safety and health and welfare and all these things? So we made him a commissioner for the day and just said, go. Yeah. And it was a lot of fun, a lot of different ideas. And I'm sure baseball, as we know, they're certainly taking their time weighing all these things currently.
Yeah, after you and I are done, I'll play for the listeners. I took a snippet of it, of Bob's postseason proposal that he said he had gotten from Jerry Reinsdorf. I'd never heard it anywhere, and it's a really good one. It's a really interesting. But let's stick to the modern moment for a second. Doug, have you had a chance to look at the 67-page document, or at least the reports on said document on the safety protocols? It's daunting, isn't it? It's daunting. It is. It's exhaustive. It is incredibly thorough. I hope it's possible. What were some of your takeaways from it?
I mean, you hit it. Every adjective you just mentioned, right? It is. It's comprehensive, to say the least. And I mean, makes sense. That's what you need to do in addressing something that is still has so much uncertainty. So they're doing everything they can to protect and create comfort and to set new standards. The daunting aspect of it is, you know, look, you know, I'm a parent of four, and just homeschooling or going anywhere, you know, which is minimal, just trying to figure out how to keep a four-year-old from touching this. And I mean, I'm trying to imagine that at a larger scale with teams and families, and, you know, literally they have down the, if you use the bullpen phone, you have to wipe it down right after. I mean, that's the detail. And who's going to, like, how are you going to get everybody to remember all these things, let alone, like, hit a curveball, right? And I mean, it's amazing. And obviously, so many people in our society now are doing this who are essential, from the medical profession to delivering groceries. So it's not that, you know, the world is enduring this right now. But when you're sort of non-essential on the entertainment side, it takes a different kind of color.
Yeah, that's true. So we are non-essential. The game is non-essential. But at some point, non-essential life is going to have to resume, and or as much of it as we can resume needs to resume. I'm not convinced that 2021 is going to look vastly different. I guess it's possible. But I mean, some of this might just be the way that life is lived in a post-virus world. And that while that is inherently pessimistic, I suppose, it does lead me to want to try.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth in that. Just let alone, even if you're, okay, this is clear, or, you know, some magic moment where it's gone. It's just the adjustments you have to make, not only from responding to how life has shifted and the fallout of it, which will have a ripple and domino effect. But it's also preparing going forward about changes in your life you're trying to make, or society as a whole, about doing things differently, right? And you know, the economics of the game, and when we're talking about baseball, the certain protocols and all these ways that we're going to see things live them differently. So that is absolutely true. And if you're not making these adjustments off of something this serious, then what are you doing? You have to change something, or you're susceptible to it all happening again and being grossly underprepared.
So if you're a player, Doug Glanville, if you're a player and you see this as presented to the union on Friday night, do you then look at it as, all right, the owners are concerned about me and they are concerned about trying to do this the right way, so let's move forward and negotiate in good faith? Or do some of them look at it and say, this is horrifying and I can't imagine doing this, screw it? What is the reaction of a player when this hits your desk on Friday night?
Yeah, well, I think you have both. You know, you Blake Snell, you know, came out and focused a lot on the economics, and that's, you know, his priority, as he expressed, and safety. But, you know, some have different circumstances. For example, if you are, we talked to Sean Doolittle on our show, and he mentioned, like, a family scenario. He said, one of my teammates just had a newborn and, you know, living with their grandparents and all. You know, these will change, you know, completely how you'll see the safety and risk. And that is very personal. So even though as a players association, you're trying to have a unified front and bring everybody together and common ground, you're also looking at each player separately and say, well, his circumstance may dictate. He's a rookie. He's 20. He's not married or whatever. He may see it differently. So that's the challenge of unifying such disparate and diverse different viewpoints into one space. I think many players will respect that, yes, the protocols were taken very seriously, but it's also going to be how are you really going to follow it? You have 50 players around. Everybody's different. Some people don't care. You might have language translation issues, all kind of questions. Who knows? I can't imagine it possible that every single player is going to follow this to the T. It's just not going to happen. And then what are your fail-safes and responses when things do go awry? Because there's going to be setbacks. I mean, come on. There's going to be setbacks in every facet of our lives, and we're going to have to figure out how to adjust there. And baseball is going to be no different.
Doug, do you think that this is a moment where the sides economically and in a business sense should look at rejiggering the entire model? I know it's a lot to think about, but here we are, and a lot of industries are going to have to think about this stuff. The inequities between the haves and the have-nots have long made the game so problematic when it comes to bargaining. And the free market system as replicating capitalism can be so that, like, is this a moment to think about more openness, revenue sharing, and a cap and a floor? Is it a moment to rethink the way that baseball does its business?
Yes. Well, I'm going to steal a quote from the Hartford Public Schools superintendent and Leslie Torres Rodriguez, and she says, "Change happens at the speed of trust." And so one of the problems you have is, although innovation is a great opportunity right now, you have to believe in confidence with each other and work in good faith. And there is just still a lot of mistrust that exists between ownership and the Players Association. And you know, on a public domain, that will not be taken well if you end up not being able to move forward when you can, because, you know, you're fighting over, you know, or negotiating over things in a very, without the good faith that you need, whether it's economics or whatever. So they have to get, you know, past that hurdle. And there's no doubt that that's where everything moves forward from that vantage point. So although the opportunities are there, you know, seven-inning games and, you know, whatever you have, you know, doubleheaders, bringing back the days of doubleheaders and bullpen carts or whatever you have, you have to, you know, come together on these innovations. And when you don't have the trust, you're going to see every move as some economic opportunity to create advantage. That's where the trust will break things down. So you're going to go, oh, well, wait a minute. Are you doing this because you're trying to not pay us? Or, you know, okay, you say you have $4 billion in losses, but what's really in that number? Can we audit your books? You know, and so on. So that's where you have these sticking points of innovation, because you're not going to see it in this collective way. So they really have to get past those hurdles, because I think there's a great opportunity here and a very exciting one about looking at the game, not only economically, but rules, and just say, hey, here's a chance we could kind of rewrite some things and improve the game for the future.
Yeah, it is an opportunity, but boy, that's the speed of trust. It's that's a pretty slow speed historically between these two sides, yep. Unfortunately. Like so much of the country, I've been watching and obsessed with The Last Dance on ESPN. It's been great fun. And that Jordan-esque chip on the shoulder that we basically name for him, that, it, you know, inventing the slights or using actual slights, using the motivation to get more out of himself. You shared a story on that episode of Starkville. Would you mind sharing with the listeners that one day of deeply personal motivation with which you went to the ballpark and went to the plate, if you could share that?
Yes. Oh, well, in terms of, oh, yeah, for me personally, yes,
there's
no, no doubt. Well, you know, Jordan talked a lot about it, and you saw it in his world of how he could will himself, right, seemingly, in these scenarios. And basketball is so different than baseball. you know, baseball, we have, you know, these 162 games. It's, you know, you're trying to pace yourself. You're trying to – so it's hard to be that Jordan mindset every day. And when I played against Jordan that year, I remember him telling our third baseman that he's like, man, I've never been this tired in my entire life after he played like 100 straight games in a row. So that was a great nod to baseball, that the mental wear down is so severe. It's not the physical demands quite the same. So for me personally, I tried to parallel some moment where I felt Jordan-esque. And The moment I could only come up with was the last game of the 2002 season. I had 998 hits. And it was, you know, the end of the year, and we're definitely out of it. We're in Florida against the Marlins. And my dad had been sick for 3 years, and this is year three. So I knew from my last visit that this was kind of the beginning of the end. He had strokes, he had cancer, and I'd, you know, been driving up to ERs from up into Jersey from Philly, like for years at that point. So he's gravely ill, and he's in a hospital in Jersey, and I have 998 hits, and there's one game left in the season, and Carl Pavano's on the mound. And there was a lot of battle, the three-game series, because I had 996, I think, going into that three-game series. And Larry Bo was my manager, and he wasn't playing me. And finally, the PR rep, Lee Tobin, said, look, you need to play him. We're not going anywhere. He can get 1,000 hits this weekend. So he sat me the first day, and if there's divine intervention, Pat Burrell in the second game gets hurt sliding into home plate, and I have to go in for him, and I get 2 hits. So I have 998 now. Last game, Pavano's on the mound, and I woke up and I said, there's no way Carl Pavano is getting me out today. It's like, and I'd never, you know, said that in such a deep belief and faith than ever in my career. I felt confident. I played well. I had good years. But I was like, there's no way this guy is getting me out. And so I got a hit in the first 3 at-bats. I was 3 for 3, got my 1,000th hit. And my dad passed away at 7:15 p.m. that night, when the game ended, literally as I walked off the field. And so I buried him with that baseball, 1,000th hit, and I put it in his casket. So that's Jordan on a day-to-day basis. So it's unfathomable, the drain and the energy it took. So his mind needs to be like in the Hall of Fame just on its own, his spirit of competition. But I just could not. It made me feel, watching The Last Dance, I go, wow, I could have been a lot better, I guess. I mean, I had a good career, but I mean, that's when I come away. So I can only relate to that moment when I was facing life and death with my own family. That's how serious it was.
Wow, that's a beautiful, amazing story. And it's amazing because there's this long-held belief that it's just not possible in baseball to have that chip and play that way, because the harder you try, the harder the game can get. But what you're saying is an argument that maybe it is possible, that you can focus a bit more and give yourself that kind of external motivation and rise. I mean, I know it's true in other aspects of our lives, so why shouldn't it be true in baseball?
Yeah, I mean, and no question that you look at the great players, the Hall of Famers, they do find a way to balance this need to be even keeled to a certain degree, and then be this hyper-focused, laser-confident person to compete every day. And, you know, I think when you play as long as you do, I was fortunate to get, you know, 9 years in, you have these ebbs and flows, you know, rookie year, and then it's like year 5, and you're 30 games out of first place, and you're like, okay, what's going on here? I mean, it's a challenge, and baseball just has that. As Jimmy Pearsall used to say to me, he's like, this game will bring you to your knees, so you better be ready every day, because as soon as you start doing things half, as Tony Muser, our coach, used to say, you all of a sudden you're kind of in the big leagues, you kind of your way right out of the game. So it takes that really tough balance, the high lows, to even it out, but yet be so focused. So I think I had years like, you know, certainly in 99, I had that kind of year, and the numbers reflected it. But wow, to do it every year in, as you're getting older, really mind-blowing what Jordan was able to do.
Doug Glanville hit .325 in 1999, an on-base percentage of .376 with 34 stolen bases, and one of 4 years in a row with over 600 at-bats. So the man played an awful lot. I saw somebody giving you crap on Twitter the other day for your mediocre Cub career, and you're like, hitting .300 wasn't bad. It was a solid clapback, a well-executed clapback, sir. Tell people about pickup basketball with Michael Jordan in 1994. I had no idea that Lyle Mouton could ball, by the way. I had no idea, but Lyle played college ball, and he was one of your teammates in that game, right?
Yes, he did, LSU. And Curtis Pride was another teammate who played, I think it was, St. Mary's, William & Mary? I'm not sure the exact, but he was a point guard. So, so Jordan, when he played, so keep in mind, I played against him all of 94, right? So all through the Southern League. I was in Orlando, he's in Birmingham, and I met him a couple times. And, you know, that was obviously amazing, but he worked before the game and after the game. So season ends, he goes to the Arizona Fall League, and I go to the Arizona Fall League, and Terry Francona is his manager, both places. So they start playing pickup basketball games, like more of like one-on-one, three-on-three, and then it spirals to the whole league hears about it, and we get invited to come. And so we put a team together, five of us, and we go to this Scottsdale Community College, and Jordan's there. It's surreal seeing him on the court, and I have video to prove this, by the way. So he's out there, and crazy enough, we keep feeding Mouton, posting up, and somehow we actually win this 5-on-5 versus Michael Jordan, right? So I don't even tell this story because I keep thinking Jordan is so competitive, he literally might pull up in my driveway and challenge me to one-on-one to settle this. All right, so I kind of like whisper this story, but we actually win this game. And I think Francona took the final shot and missed, and Jordan was trying to pass. He was trying to be unselfish. And, I mean, so look, I'm sure if he was playing, you know, for the NBA championship, he would have destroyed us, and, you know, I'm sure. But we actually did end up with one more, you know, basket than they did. So, and he was upset. He kicked the ball into the rafters after the game and all this. But so I can go down and actually tell that true story. I still don't really – I pinch myself trying to figure it out, but the video is there.
Oh, tremendous. You got him.
And he would trash talk. If you were wearing Reeboks, he'd say, oh, I'm coming at you, like one-on-one. he'd look at you and say – this, what I'm about to do to you right now, you're going to tell your grandkids. I mean, he was hilarious. And, but wow, that was unbelievable. But I got dunked on intentionally at one point. You know, I was pretty fast, so I can run with anybody. And he had a little bit of a breakaway. I actually ran him down, at half court. I took off. And then I knew somewhere in there he was about to, you know, take flight. So I said, you know what, I'm going to still try to block this shot just to see what happens. So he basically takes off at the free throw line. I jump, and he's literally sitting on my head when he slammed the ball. And I could play a little bit above the rim. So that was just like, that's why he shot those line drive shots, because when he jumped, even his jump shots, he was shooting downhill. That's how high he got. And to see it on the court was like watching SpaceX or something. It just like made no sense on how high this guy got up. It was just mind-blowing.
Wow, what a tremendous experience to catalog away. And I got to say, I love thinking about Curtis Pride. I always rooted for him. Born deaf, and I just looked him up. I didn't realize he's the baseball coach at Gallaudet. How perfect is that, right? I did not know that. That's wonderful.
Yeah, he was a great player. He could play.
Yeah, you sure could. All right, last thing, Doug, you and I were talking. What is your – we've talked about the spinners before, lots of Hall & Oates. Why Sam Cooke? What is hitting you hard about Sam Cooke right now? His story is fascinating, eventually so dark, as a lot of people know, but, you know, a gospel singer in the 50s, moved to Chicago, went to Phillips Academy, same as Nat King Cole, not far from where I'm sitting right now, as a matter of fact. But what's hitting you about Sam Cooke right now?
Man, you know, Sam Cooke, I'm not even sure when I first, you know, heard him, but I just connected, you know, just the music, the harmonies. He's just sort of catchy. And I learned a little bit more about his story because there was a book out years ago called You Send Me. Mm-hmm. And then there's a documentary on Netflix. So I watched that fairly recently. And I think one real strange, surreal connection was where the Hotel Figaro, or I can't remember where he got shot, but I know the address was somewhere in like California, LA proper. Yep. And I was driving, we were going to a game playing against the Dodgers or the Phillies, and as I was reading the part about where he got shot, I was literally in that neighborhood as we turned on the bus. So I was like, whoa, this is deep. So I learned a lot more about him. But I think the compelling story from the Netflix story is just how he was really the socially conscious vocalist that had this beautiful ability to sort of span many different diverse people, right? But yet he had this activist side to him that was very driven by trying to create equity for the black community. And so you could see, you know, he was on the cusp of really becoming this sort of transformational figure. I mean, he was already number two to Elvis in sales. I mean, he was still already big time. But you think of, you know, people cut short, whether it's like Aaliyah or these sort of great talented singers that you go, gosh, like what could have been? And yes. Kurt Cobain and so on. So I just found it to be such a connecting story because he was great. I mean, and he was, you know, talking to Ali, and he just found, but he had a deep conscience, but also understood the business side. So, you know, cut down very short, very early in life, and tragically. So his music is just, it's so powerful. Like Change Gonna Come and all. I mean, these songs are just like hit you in the soul.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Just a fascinating guy and considered by a lot of people to be like the father of soul music, just the beginnings of it, but bringing the church to the secular. And he added the E at the end of his name to signify the beginning of a new life. I love that when he realized he was going to go secular. Well, we'll go out with a little. This is Bring It On Home to Me, which might be my favorite. You know who's singing with him on this? The Low Harmony? I didn't know it for a long time, and when I learned it, I can never unhear it. Here, turn it up for a second, Sean.
Yeah.
If you ever change your mind about leaving me behind, oh, bring it to me, bring your sweet loving, bring it on home to me.
You know who's singing that harmony with him?
Doug? Oh. Wow, Ray Charles, who's singing with him?
It's a good guess. His childhood friend, Lou Rawls.
Lou Rawls. Wow.
You'll never find.
You'll
right?
never find. Yes. Man. That's, I mean,
from a rival gospel band, Lou Rawls, and Sam said, "Come on over here. Come on, sing this with me."
Yeah, and he did a track with Muhammad Ali. I mean, this guy, you know, he really got it, just like to connect people, but. Yeah, just tragic, and what a voice, like Marvin Gaye, it was almost an instrument, so I encourage everybody to check out his greatest hits. I mean, there's so many songs that when you listen to you go, oh yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
There's that one, and that one, and that one, and that one.
Exactly.
Doug, a pleasure, I can talk to you all day. Thank you for the time, stay healthy, stay safe, and let's hope we get some baseball soon.
Yeah, Matt, always a pleasure. Take care.
All right. Thank you. You too. Right. That's Doug Glanville right there on 670 The Score.
Okay. Picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.